It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about mountain rescue. When Alaskans get lost or hurt in the high country, we rely on a team of volunteers and professionals who are tough and brave enough to come get us in the worst conditions. We'll be finding out how they do their work this week and how we can help as outdoor users when we're lost and to keep from getting lost in the first place. Regardless of our preparation, people do get hurt and unwanted adventures are the result. Today we're talking to the people who wait for those calls and show up when we need them most. And I have two guests in the studio with me right now who are involved with search and rescue issues all the time. We were just talking about the incredible number of calls that come in. Hopefully no calls will come in the next hour while we're doing the show. Lieutenant Steve Adams with the Alaska State Troopers handles search and rescue issues and coordinating with 40 volunteer groups around the state that go out and work on search and rescue. Thanks for being with us, Lieutenant Adams.
Thank you.
And Dean Knapp is with Alaska Mountain Rescue, which is a group here in Anchorage, a volunteer group of folks who go out when the calls come to help people who are lost, who are hurt, and who are up there in the mountains. And not all sort of Mount Everest-type adventures. Sounds like the majority of your calls, Dean, are coming from Flat Top and Crow Creek Pass Trail, where many, many of our listeners go all the time.
Well, last year, about half our calls were Crow Pass or Flat Top. Mm-hmm. But we also do a lot of two guys with a pickup and two snow machines behind it, and they take off on a January morning, and at midnight, the wife calls and says the guys didn't come back. Mm-hmm. And troopers will find where that pickup is parked, and they'll check it out, and it's cold, and it's frosted over, and the trailer's empty. And they'll say, they went snow machining from this point, but they could have gone anywhere. And they turn that mission over to us. So it can be almost anybody in Anchorage, any visitor that we're looking for.
Well, that's what seems amazing about this is a volunteer job, is that you have no idea what you're going to be doing when the phone rings.
That's true. It's kind of the nature of emergency service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and we've got some stats up on the website that you provided about how many people get lost doing which activities. And that's pretty interesting, too. We'll talk about that later in the hour. Steve, you, from the trooper's perspective, the call comes in and you kind of decide who you're going to dispatch and how you're going to dispatch them. And I think a lot of people would be surprised that you don't really have the assets to cover all of these calls yourself. You actually need volunteers.
Right. You know, the Department of Public Safety is charged by statute to respond to all land-based search and rescues for the entire state. My job as the state search and rescue coordinator is to make sure that the trooper in the field who gets assigned that search and rescue has the resources that he or she needs to effectively get that job done. So, you know, we only have about 400 troopers around the state. We typically, you know, receive about 700 calls that start out as search and rescues per year. Of which about 350 to 400 actually turn out to be actual search and rescues.
So you're averaging over one a day of a real search and rescue situation.
Yes.
Through the year.
And it comes and goes. I mean, this morning we had three going on.
Wow.
At the same time in different parts of the state. And they'll be spread out. We had one up on the Hall Road north of Fairbanks, 293 miles north of Fairbanks. One going on in Nome or outside of Nome between Nome and Teller. And one outside of Dillingham, all at the same time.
Hmm. And so as a coordinator, you are pulling in these volunteer assets to help the troopers out there because you simply don't have the manpower to do it. How do you know that you can trust these groups, that they're going to be professional?
Well, you know, we have all kinds of different levels of ability and mm-hmm. levels of training and levels of dedication. There are a number of groups that we work with all the time, such as the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, who we know are very, very effective and very well-trained and very disciplined group. And sometimes we'll rely on a group that we don't know as much, such maybe in the case in a lot of the Western villages. We may just have a group of eager volunteers that may know mm-hmm. the victim.
The cousin is missing, and they jump on the snow machines and go look for him, basically.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So, but the fact that we, you know, we affect a lot of our search and rescues here in the state by utilizing volunteers, and we eagerly accept pretty much any help we can get.
Mm-hmm. So a mountain rescue group, Dean, is a group that has presumably a pretty high level of mountaineering skill, because you can be faced with situations where you're doing these very steep rescues from very steep conditions. And you provided us with a picture we're putting on our website at alaskapublic.org of basically a vertical rescue, and the rescuer has got the victim tied up in some kind of a sled and is sort of lowering him down a vertical cliff face. That takes some significant skill to be able to do that kind of work.
Yeah, Charles, first thing, we try to use the word subject rather than victim.
Okay.
Because it sounds like they're not undergoing such a horrible ordeal. And a lot of the people we're looking for are really quite heroic. We talk to them and we don't consider them victims at all.
Hmm.
We do try to recruit pretty experienced climbers. And it's one of the disciplines within our group, high angle rescue. So we will do technical rescues going up or down cliff faces and into crevasses to pull people out. But that's a very small number of our missions involve that.
Mm-hmm.
So we train in wilderness search, in high angle rescue, and in avalanche search. The high angle rescue gets us the best pictures.
Yeah, well, and it sort of seems like the scariest and most extreme, and where your skills would be essential, because if somebody is stuck on a cliff face, we can't get them with a helicopter. You can't get them with, mm-hmm. You have to have a climber to get up there and get them.
Yeah, and we use a two-rope system and a lot more safety equipment than climbers usually use.
Mm-hmm.
Climbers traditionally are on one rope and pretty lightly dressed.
Mm-hmm.
But this is rescue, so we go in a lot heavier with a better trained team.
Well, who would be a typical example of somebody gets stuck in that type of situation? Would it be a technical climber who gets hurt, or is it more likely somebody who's just out for a Sunday afternoon and gets in over their head?
You know, one that we see a lot is a car with a family stops somewhere along Turnagain Arm at a nice viewpoint, and teenagers mm-hmm. say, "Well, look at the nice rock," and they start climbing up.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't planned to climb. They're not technical climbers. They're not using rope. They're just scrambling.
Mm-hmm.
But they find out it's easier to go up than it is to come down.
Boy, is that ever true. You get up there, you look down, and it's suddenly terrifying, right?
So sometimes we get calls about teenagers or people in their early 20s just stuck on the rock somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of scary, because there's no protection until we can get there and get an anchor and tie them in.
Right.
A technical climber is easier to rescue. He's already got a harness on. He's probably already tied in.
Right. So how does that call, I'm just curious as how that call reaches you. So let's just take the example of a teenager who's, 30 feet, 50 feet up a cliff on the Seward Highway. You need to get there pretty quick because he's holding on with his fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you, how does it, the mom or dad dials 911. Where did that call come to, and how does the chain of events get to where the rescue climber is there helping him? Steve, what's the first step there?
Typically, depending on how far down the Seward Highway we're talking about mm-hmm. in Turnagain Arm, that call will either go to the Anchorage Fire Department or to the Soldotna Public Safety Dispatch Center. The Anchorage Fire Department are a great partner in helping us with search and rescue, but they also recognize the Department of Public Safety has that responsibility. So, and they recognize also that typically firefighters have enough of a job trying to train for other types of emergencies, and they're typically not trained in these types of emergencies, and they're certainly not equipped when they jump out of a fire truck with their turnout gear to go mm-hmm. up a rock like that. So they recognize that the need is there for a group like the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group. They'll transfer that call to the state troopers. That'll go then to the Girdwood post. It'll get assigned to a trooper, and that trooper will assess the situation and then start making the request for the resources that he or she needs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the call comes into me.
Okay. And then do you have like one person at Mountain Rescue Group that you call, and they, or do you, how does that work?
Typically all organized search and rescue volunteer groups will have a dispatch system. It's typically a one number to call, and that number will get passed around mm-hmm. with different members who volunteer to be the dispatcher for a particular time frame. which gives us a one primary point of contact, and we call that person, and then they start calling out members.
So that's going to be that person's cell phone. They could be at a hockey game or whatever.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay, so Dean, that call shows up. Maybe it's you, and you're at a hockey game. Then what do you do?
Well, we have two agency representatives who are carrying these cell phones at all mm-hmm. times, or their cell phone will light up when the number's called. It's a redundancy system in case one of them can't answer. And I do that occasionally. And if I get that call, I try to quickly gather as much information as I can about the request and decide if we are able to handle it. For someone stuck on a rock up above turning an arm somewhere, I would want to send 6 technical climbers. Hmm. It's not a big mission for us. But we've got about 20 who are qualified to do that. So we would put out a page, and we use a multiple system that hits their internet email addresses. It hits their phones. It just lights up every contact we can get. Mm-hmm. And when I have 4 who call back and say I can go, I'll tell the dispatcher, okay, we're taking that mission. And then I'll try to get them a few backups, 2 more or 4 more.
Uh-huh. And then they just jump in their private cars and take off.
Yep.
Yes. And they just keep their. Do you guys just keep your gear in the car all the time, or?
Well, the climbers have 200 feet of rope in each person's pack mm-hmm. and their own personal equipment, and that's usually, you know, with 4 of them, that's 800 feet of rope. We can usually tackle a mission just on what they have in their packs. Mm-hmm. If there's more equipment needed, then somebody has to go over to Trooper Headquarters and pick up our trailer and bring it down. Mm-hmm. We have a trailer prepackaged with. Equipment ready for a larger mission, litters and oxygen and medical kits and a lot more rope.
Yeah. I mean, just listening to this, and number one, it's amazing that volunteers are doing this and are just sort of ready for that call to come, and that if I'm in trouble, all these volunteer strangers are suddenly going to show up. And the other thing it makes me think is I better be kind of able to take care of myself, because even if it's right on the highway, it's got to take you at least an hour to get out there, right? I mean, if you're calling these guys, they're dropping whatever they're doing, getting in their private cars, getting their gear together, and driving down the highway. You can't. Mountain rescue doesn't happen instantly.
Correct. We once had a call for a subject who had slipped into a crevasse on Byron Glacier down near Portage Lake. And as I was driving toward the scene, I was watching a beautiful sunset in my rearview mirror, thinking, uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
And we did night helicopter operations to get close to the glacier, and we had a team climbing on that glacier at night.
Wow.
And it's kind of a high-risk
response. Yeah, it takes a lot of courage to do that kind of work and to be ready to jump into that kind of situation.
Well, in that case, I was ready to run the command post and work that clipboard really hard. But we put other people up on the rock in the ice.
Somebody else had the courage that day, huh? Well, you were still ready to drop whatever you're doing. I mean, I think about my life, and if I was constantly getting calls and, drive to Portage or drive, up to Crow Pass or to Pioneer Peak or something, that would be a significant amount of time and disruption and a big commitment to do that.
Yeah. On big searches like the Mount Marathon event in Seward, 4th of July, 2012.
Mm-hmm. Where just disappeared, never was found, right?
We had people go down and basically move to Seward for 3 days to work on that search.
That's really impressive. Really, people owe you a big debt of gratitude for that. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about mountain rescue. If you get lost or get hurt in the mountains around Anchorage or the whole South Central region, who comes and gets you, and who are these people, and how do they do their job? In the second half, we're going to talk more about how to help them out and how to not get lost. And I've got 2 guests in the studio, Dean Knapp with the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group. It's a volunteer group of these hardy and, I would say, courageous guys and women who go out and help out when someone's lost or in trouble. And Lieutenant Steve Adams with the Alaska State Troopers, who coordinates the rescues for all over the state. I'd like to go through maybe a couple of your bigger efforts, some of the things that were really challenging, right in our region, that people could identify spots where we all recreate, and kind of go through some of those major events. I recall years ago a big avalanche event in Powerline Pass. You know, there was a huge turnout for that. There have been various events. Avalanches, I guess you're usually just going and collecting the bodies, because by the time you get there, they probably are no longer alive unless they have their own self-rescue. But what are some of the biggies that come to your mind that you felt like really proud of and that took a lot of effort? Steve, do you want to start on that one?
Well, I would, but I wasn't in this position mm-hmm. during the Powerline Pass, so mm-hmm. I'll probably have to defer to Dean
sure,
on that.
Sure, I'm just an example. Just something that you were, that comes to your mind that, as being something that was pretty interesting.
We've had a number of significant search and rescues over the last year and a half, and I've been in the SAR coordinator position. A couple of them have to do with Butte Creek off the Denali Highway. We've got a section of the creek there that it's a popular place for hunters. They cross the creek there. It's not very far from the mouth that feeds into the Susitna River. And so we've lost two people in a row in that creek in the last year and a half.
Guys were trying to ford the creek?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Water's too high. They get tired of waiting. Even though they have gear and they could wait, they just get tired of waiting and they try it. Unfortunately, they have failed. Mm-hmm. And that's an area in search and rescue like avalanches where, water rescue, we're just, and it's Alaska. We just don't do well with water. And the same with avalanches, unless we have rescuers right there, or the subjects are very well prepared with avalanche beacons and some of the technology that's out there today, mm-hmm. there's not much we can do but try to recover the body and provide closure for the family. Crow Creek Pass is something that comes up all the time, and it's. It's a hike that people underestimate. They underestimate the time it's going to take to get across there. They underestimate water levels for the crossings. And we get overdue hiker calls for Crow Creek Pass all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult area to get into because we typically are weathered out of there mm-hmm. from getting a helicopter up there. So we typically start a Crow Creek Pass call with giving a little bit more time, because typically if we give it another 6 or 8 hours,
They'll show up, right.
They catch up with their schedule, uh-huh. so to speak. And if that doesn't work, then
that must be a hard call, though, when the family is beside themselves and upset and they say, go look for them right now.
It is. But we have to take a look at that initial interview with the reporting party. And we take a look at when did the person start, when did they say they were going to come out, and then take a look at, what's the likelihood they could actually make it across the pass in that time frame.
Right. They underestimated it in the first place. They're not named Strabel, so it takes them more than a few hours to get across.
Right. Yeah. And then we try to pinpoint the likelihood of where they would be in the trail and then send in a team from there. Mm-hmm. And that's where Alaska Mountain Rescue comes in, with a lot of our search and rescues, the Crow Creek Pass and Flat Top, mm-hmm. because a lot of people go up to Flat Top very ill prepared for mm-hmm. what they're getting into.
So, Dean, what are some of the ones that highlight to you as being some of the more adventurous rescues that you guys have had to pull off, or ones that were complicated or challenging?
Well, one really challenging mission comes to mind in August of 2012 on Mount Maynard, which is the mountain above the Whittier Tunnel. So if you're driving through the tunnel to Whittier, that 4,000 feet above you is Mount Maynard. A day or two before, these were two state geologists, scientists. A helicopter dropped them at two separate locations up on top of the ridgeline. And it was an unusual mission in that these folks were pretty well prepared. The helicopter pilot was able to give us coordinates and elevations for the landing zones he used where he dropped them. Both of the subjects had cell phone and VHF radio and satellite phone, so we knew exactly where the subjects were, and we had good communication with them. Very unusual for us. But the problem was, after the helicopter dropped them off and flew away, they thought they'd be up there 3 or 4 hours taking samples, and nasty weather blew in. and suddenly you had driving rain sideways at 45 miles an hour, zero visibility. They're exposed, they're getting wet. And they consulted, and the helicopter pilot was not able to get back in that night. They waited through one night in improvised shelters. Didn't have tents. One had a snow cave that kind of protected him from wind from one direction. The other was in a rock shelter. And the second day, they called for help. And troopers got us staged and ready to go at the Whittier Tunnel. But it's very challenging. We're the only group that could get up onto that mountain. The bottom part of it is thick alder and no trails. And we didn't want to hack our way through that. So we tried to leapfrog up under the clouds with helicopters and get started lower on the mountain at maybe 1,500 feet.
Mm-hmm. It could take you a day to get through the alders on those mountains. I mean, you're just so slow. Yeah,
and that's why we wanted to skip that and helicopter up to the bottom of the cloud layer. It was two separate missions because these climbers are separated by, or geologists were separated by about a mile and a half. And two separate teams taking two separate routes, two separate helicopter insertions. And one of them got turned back by...
When you talk about insertion, you can't land a helicopter on the side of a mountain, so you lower them on some kind of a rappel from the helicopter?
No, we do not rappel from helicopters. If you need that capability, we'll call the Air National Guard.
Uh-huh.
The helicopter pilots are attempting to find a flat spot and land out in the wilderness, which has its own danger.
Yeah.
One of those teams got turned back by blowing snow across an ice field, and the pilot said, we're not landing there. Mm-hmm. One team got inserted partway up the mountain. That team hiked in and got to within about 400 vertical feet of their subject. They knew where she was, but by that time it was pitch dark. They decided it was not safe to climb the next 400 feet in the dark, in blowing wind and rain, horrible conditions. So they bivouacked overnight until first light, tried to get some sleep. It was very frustrating for them because they knew the subject they were attempting to rescue was only about 400 feet away.
So you probably needed help bad at that point.
Well, you have to figure she's getting cold and she hasn't had food and probably limited on water, so hypothermia is a real possibility.
Mm-hmm.
They... reached her early the next morning, and one of our volunteers pulled out from his pack two slices of Moose's Tooth pizza and handed it to her. She was very happy.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Perfect.
And so we're now into the third day, and the weather is lifting a little bit. The ceiling's coming up. So we were able to reach both subjects with foot teams on the third day and walk them partway down where helicopters were able to pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a spectacular mission for us.
Wow. So we're going to go to a break in a moment. But, Steve, I have to, with all this discussion of helicopters, I have to think about the tragedy that took place with Hilo 1 recently. And it sounds like the troopers have made some changes in how you're handling your aviation. This is dangerous work in helicopters. So there was also a tragedy a few years ago in Prince William Sound with a medical helicopter. How do you – you've got to constantly be balancing the – danger of leaving the person out there and the danger of flying. How do you guys manage those decisions?
Well, that decision is always going to is going to lie on the shoulders of the pilot. We're never going to make that decision for the pilot. Not anybody in the SAR community would ever ask the pilot to do anything that the pilot's not comfortable with, and nor anybody in DPS. So, it's a very difficult decision to make. But, something that people need to understand is that in Alaska, when you dial 911, help is not immediately there. And we have lots of areas in the state where it's very, very difficult to get to you, even if we know exactly where you are. And typically, these days with technology the way it is, we search for a lot less people that are actually lost. And we rescue a lot more people that we know exactly where they are. And typically, it's medical situations. This morning, we had one up off of the Hall Road. That's an area of the state that we have no EMS system. So, although we have a brand new helicopter in Fairbanks that just arrived last week, we haven't yet set up those refueling points that to go that far north yet. So it's a it's very, very difficult. Very difficult decisions to make.
And I guess just reading about the report in the newspaper, decision's been made to stop using the night vision goggles because that's a challenging thing for handling. And I was thinking, Dean, when what you were talking about is, if you think about sort of tactical equipment that's used by the military in a situation like what you're talking about, they would be using night vision goggles. They'd be using a lot of additional equipment. Is there, I mean, it sounds like some technology you're not using, and I'd be interested in decisions you make about that. Steve, do you want to take that one first?
Well, typically what we have to do, we use a whole partnership of SAR resources around the state, and it's not just DPS aircraft. We rely heavily on the United States Coast Guard. We rely heavily on the Rescue Coordination Center, 11th Air Force, on JBAIR. And we rely heavily on the private sector as well. This morning we used, we tapped into Alyeska Pipeline to help us with the haul road. So
it's a little bit of a, every situation is different, so you're kind of improvising with every situation, figuring out what the pieces are and putting it together.
Yes, exactly.
So Dean, in terms of your guys and women who are doing these rescues, sounds like they're using their own equipment primarily. So it's not necessarily the high-tech stuff. It's just whatever they use for their own recreation.
Well, most of them have a separate pack for the rescue purposes. But they own the equipment.
Is somebody buying that for them, or are they just...
No. Okay. No, we spend a lot on rescue equipment. I bought a radio for my truck so I can do command for my truck. But for a climber to go in on foot, they've got a limit on what they can carry in their pack.
Right.
And if we give them climbing gear and 200 feet of rope, plus they're taking extra clothing for their hypothermic subject, maybe extra food for the subject, a tent, probably the last thing I would want to add to that load is night vision goggles.
Right.
How often are you going to use those?
Right, right. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. I'm just filled with respect for what you guys do. And as an outdoor user, you know, it does, having this perspective of how difficult it is, how long it takes to get there, the hazards that the rescuers face, kind of changes your point of view a little bit. You can't, if you're not prepared, if you're not being careful, if you don't know where you are or have the right equipment, you're not just putting yourself at risk. You're also putting at risk all these folks who would come and look for you. And you can't count on them to be there at the snap of a finger. So, great topic. And we're going to continue more with it in the second half of the show, planning to talk a bit about how you, as an outdoor user, can be safe and prevent incidents from taking place. And if an incident does take place, what should you be doing to make sure that you can be rescued safely? We've been talking with Dean Knapp with Alaska Mountain Rescue, Lieutenant Steve Adams with the Alaska State Troopers. We will continue with the discussion soon, but first it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Tomorrow, February 14th, Anchorage will participate in Winter Bike to Work Day, celebrated internationally in winter cities. Register anytime before Friday at winterbiketoworkday.org/commit and travel by bike on Friday. Celebrate at Westchester Lagoon, 4:30 to 6 p.m. For more info on Winter Bike to Work Day, go to bicycleanchorage.org. Animals leave telltale signs of their presence. On Saturday, February 15th, go to the Eagle River Nature Center and learn how to read their tracks. Dress for going outdoors. This junior naturalist program is for kids kindergarten through sixth grade. The program fee is free with a $5 parking fee for non-members. For more info on animal tracks in the snow at the Eagle River Nature Center, go to ernc.org. There will be a bear skinning and hunting class at the Denina Center in Anchorage on Saturday, February 22, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game will host this free clinic in conjunction with the Safari Club International Alaska Chapter. Learn how to properly skin a bear hide to remove the feet and skull and turn the lips, ear, and nose. Basic hunting strategies will also be discussed on the second floor of the Denina Center. For more info on the bear skinning and hunting clinic, call 907-267-2000.
2534. Finally, the Susitna 100 and Little Sioux 50K happened this weekend. To tell us more, we have with us by phone Assistant Race Director Aaron Kittredge. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Charles.
Well, this is a race that has sort of multiple ways you can do it, as shown even by the logo on your website. Tell us about what the Susitna 100 is all about.
Exactly. It's a human-powered race, so your division can be bike, ski, or foot. This year might not lend itself to skiing with no snow, but
it'll be a good year to bike, right?
Yeah, it could be, and I think the runners will be pleased, too. So
where does the race start and end? And 100K, I mean, are you expected to do that all at once?
Well, it's not 100K, it's 100 miles. And
100
yes,
miles,
are.
Oh my gosh. Ah, that's too much.
There's a 50K, but a 100-miler. This year we moved the trail, or the course, and it's starting at Martin Boozer's Happy Trail Kennels in Big Lake. That's the start and finish. Goes up to Point McKenzie, Flathorn Lake, Little Sioux, Deschka Landing, Cow Lake, and back. And that's the 100-mile.
Have you done this?
I have not, but I've been involved with all the fantastic participants for years, and they inspire me, but not quite that much.
I know. It just seems like it just sounds too difficult. I know folks who have done it, and I just find it extraordinary because 100 miles is... I mean, it's a whole different type of trip. It's not, you know, it's something you'd really want to be prepared for.
Certainly, and the weather is such a factor, and overnight, sleep deprivation, all of that plays into it where a shorter race doesn't. But that's one of the reasons we developed the Little Sioux 50K, too. It kind of gives people a little chance to get their feet wet, I guess, figuratively. It is that's a 12-hour cutoff point. So a lot of people start out with that and then switch to the 100.
How do people get involved?
Well, the Susitna 50K sells out really quick, so that was already done in full in November. You do have one more chance to sign up for the 100. It ends, I think, tonight, Thursday the 13th at 5:30 at the Lusac Library. We have a gear check, a pre-race meeting, and you can. That's your last opportunity to sign up for the 100, and we still have spaces there.
Are you looking for volunteers to help for folks who may be not ready to dive in the deep end?
You know, we have such a great core of volunteers. We've added a few new people because people are always interested. But I think we're good this year. And,
right.
And you get hooked on the race and you stay involved for a long time. We're very fortunate there.
So who usually wins? The bikers? The skiers? Probably not the runners.
Every year it's different. That's the exciting part, right? Because of the weather. You know, if it dumps a foot of snow the night before the race, the bikers are not going to have fun. And we don't require that you declare your division until race morning. So that gives people a chance to, you know, if they were going to run it and it's, you know, not running weather, then they can change to bike.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us, Aaron Kittredge from the Susitna 100.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be on KSKA.
I appreciate it. And we'll have a link to the Susitna 100 as well as all links to all the events mentioned on today's Outdoor Explorer calendar at alaskapublic.org. And please stay with us for the second half of the show, and we'll continue to talk about Alaska Mountain Rescues when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're back. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about mountain rescue, about the volunteers and the state troopers who respond when one of us outdoor folk gets lost or gets hurt in the mountains and needs to be helped. And in the first half, we heard some adventure stories, and we heard some information about how these rescues are mounted. And it's extraordinary the number of moving parts that are required and the volunteers who respond to go out and help. And some of which requires quite a bit of bravery, and all of which requires a lot of volunteer time devoted to others, strangers. And one of the things that made me realize is that as outdoors folk, we really need to be thoughtful about not getting lost, not getting hurt, not only for ourselves and our families, but also because of the folks who have to come after us. And how can we make their lives easier? Once you're waiting for a rescuer, there's probably nothing you've ever wanted more than to see that person come and get you. How do you help that happen? So we're going to talk about that a little bit here in the second half of Outdoor Explorer. Lieutenant Steve Adams is with me from the Alaska State Troopers. He coordinates search and rescue around the state. And Dean Knapp with Alaska Mountain Rescue, the volunteer group here in Anchorage that takes care of a lot of the search and rescue issues that take place in our mountains. So, Steve, obviously, some of the things are, I think we all know, if you're heading into the backcountry, somebody needs to know where you're going and when you plan to be back, and be ready to call the troopers if you don't show up, because for the most part, in our backcountry, you're not going to be able to call on a cell phone, and you can't count on being able to contact the troopers and dial 911 yourself.
Yes. You know, the first thing that people need to do is we have a document. It's just a one-page form on our website, the TPS website, called the Wilderness Trip Plan. And it's a simple, you know, fill-in-the-blank form that you fill out, and you put it on the refrigerator with a magnet, and you tell somebody that it's there. And, you know, you'll have this form shows exactly where you're going, what you're taking with you, and when do you expect to return. And the instructions that people give when they put this form on the refrigerator is, if I'm not back by X, call, you know, the troopers. And that's really important because, you know, if we know where to look, that's half the battle. That's half the battle. You know, the other part is how ill-prepared people are when they go out into the woods. They don't wear the proper types of clothing. They don't wear the proper footwear. Mm-hmm. They don't take any sort of the electronics that can save their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, a proper communication system, whether it's a satellite phone or a spot beacon or a
personal... Well, not to interrupt you, but it seems like I'm just wondering what percentage of people that you look for have actually filled out that kind of trip plan in detail, because it seems like if you're together enough to do that, you're probably together enough to know where you are and have the right equipment with you for the most part.
Very few. I would say if we're talking about a percentage, it's probably in the low single digits.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I've done it myself where I get to the trailhead and I think, oh gosh, we didn't tell anybody where we're going. So I'll call somebody. Maybe I'm waking them up, or maybe they're like not focused. And I say, we're going this place. And then I hike down the trail. And I think, well, what's the chance that person would actually remember everything I just told them, you know, if they didn't write it down? And so it does need to be written down. You need to be serious about it.
Yes, you do. You do. You know, people need to take all of the, you know, the proper gear they think they'll need, and more. And, you know, if you don't anticipate being stuck overnight, you should. You should, because, you know, like I said, help when you call 911 is not right around the corner, especially when you leave the roadway. You need to take food and water.
Mm-hmm.
You need to take some sort of heat source and some sort of communication device. And everybody needs to go out and buy a 406 beacon, because that's the fastest way to get rescuers directly to you.
It's a personal EPIRB, or the personal locator beacon.
Yep. And go and spend the money and buy a 406.
Mm-hmm.
Look them up online, find a good one, and just make that investment.
Yeah. That must be a big relief when you know somebody's got one of those and you can just home run in on them.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I believe how those work is when it's activated, it communicates with a satellite, and that sends the word that the person needs help, right?
Yes. And here in Alaska, that information goes directly to the Rescue Coordination Center.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go to a third party, you know, like some of the other companies. And it's the newest technology. I can't stress it enough.
How much does one of those things cost?
We're talking probably, you know, right around $1,000.
Mm-hmm. And then you need to renew it every 3 or 4 years. The batteries wear out and stuff.
or at least the one I had, that you had to buy a new one. You couldn't like renew it like and refurbish it. You had to go out and buy a new one. I don't know if that's still the same way.
It may be depending on the type, but
right.
But it's a dividend.
Do a little research, right? Yeah. So, Dean, I'm hearing what Steve is saying about what to take with you, and then I'm also thinking it's a sunny day in June. You're gonna go up to Wolverine Peak, or you're gonna go up Flat Top, and you are assuming that you're gonna be fine. What would you put in that backpack? Just your family hike, and you don't expect anything's gonna go wrong. Be honest.
Well, I'm not sure how much I would take, but one thing that would be very helpful to me, and I'm quite possibly the search manager who will show up and try to figure it out if you've lost one member of your group, is when you're at the trailhead, and this is for a group of skiers or snow machiners or a family doing a hike or any group, get a couple or three people in that group to pull the cell phones out of their pockets and just take one individual picture of each person in the group. That way, if someone's missing and now it's 6 p.m. and the troopers are arriving and you're calling for help and search rescue are on the way, somebody's going to be able to bring up their phone and say, here's a picture of him today and here's what he was wearing and the pack he had on. It will help us know colors and footwear and a good level of preparation.
Wow.
That picture would be very helpful to us.
Never thought of that, because there's a lot of people up there, and how do you know you're finding the right one unless you have a picture?
We always want a description of the person, but I'd rather have a picture. And if everything's fine, everybody comes back, just erase those pictures, do it again the next trip and the next trip.
Well, one thing you have to think about as a parent, even on the easy family hike, is, and it's happened here in Anchorage, is one of the kids, you know, goes to the bathroom off the trail or takes the wrong turn or something, and then you don't know where they are. What could be scarier than that? And so the kid needs to have some idea what to do and some kind of, at the very least, I think you always need to have a layer and a waterproof layer with you, regardless of what hike you're going on.
Yeah, we had one this summer, a group of teenagers who decided to do Little O'Malley Peak, and one of the teenagers got separated from the group and was out overnight. She was not very well prepared, because they were thinking day hike, so she had basically nothing with her, wearing shorts. Fortunately, it was good weather, and she was okay. In that instance, when someone does get lost, what would be most helpful to us is if they didn't keep walking. If they can stay in one place, they're a lot easier to find. If you keep walking, you can be 3 miles away, and that's 12 square miles to search.
Right, and you could be walking into dangerous terrain that's even more difficult than wherever you are. Yeah.
In this case, we were lucky. She stopped walking because she lost her shoes in some deep mud. Uh-huh. And then she couldn't walk anymore. Uh-huh. And she was easy to find. We had her at 8:20 the next morning.
Found her by helicopter, or how'd you pick her up?
Two ground teams. They were going to the point last seen from two different directions, and they just did a pincher and came right to her.
Mm-hmm. So give me a few ideas, both of you. You are lost. I guess it would be different winter and summer, but maybe you were pretty well prepared. Maybe you're pretty experienced. I've had friends who just went down the wrong valley. You know, they thought they knew the route. They'd done it a lot of times. They got confused. Now they're going to realize, I'm going to be out here overnight. Somebody's going to be coming to look for me. What are some of the things that are best to do? And obviously being visible would be one, right, Dean?
You know, what our helicopter pilots like best is really bright colors.
Mm-hmm.
And this is especially important for hunters who tend to wear camouflage. If you could have a lightweight tarp in your pack that's fluorescent orange and only pull it out in an emergency, you could wrap yourself in it. You'll be much more visible. We're going to find you a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone will be happier.
Get out in the open. I mean, you might want to be among the trees because you get more shelter, but it'd be pretty hard to find if you're back in the trees, especially if you're in alders or something.
Correct. I've been an observer in the helicopter looking down, and it's very frustrating for the person on the ground because they hear the helicopter, they look up, they can see the helicopter. They're thinking, I can see them, why can't they see me? But when you're sitting in that left front seat in the helicopter looking down, you see 432,657 birch trees.
Mm-hmm.
And finding the one person in there is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can put on some bright colors, get out into a clearing, and maybe wave at us or shine a light, that's very helpful.
Right, which suggests another thing to have in that pack, right, Steve? I mean, in terms of, if you find yourself lost and you haven't prepared, as you were suggesting, then it becomes more difficult. Any other tips for if you are lost or if you are in trouble and need help and what you can do to help the rescuers?
Just make sure you have that ability to communicate, and you can't rely on your cell phone, not in Alaska. Have some sort of means of shelter, even if it's just a lightweight sack jack or something that gets your body out of the weather, a thin raincoat, rain pants that add no weight to your pack, some food, some water, and some sort of heat source, some way to start a fire.
Mm-hmm. And when we're thinking about wintertime, obviously there's a whole additional set of equipment you need for avalanche self-rescue because, as we've discussed earlier in the show, if you're caught in an avalanche, you're not going to be rescued. I mean, the chances that you're going to be rescued by somebody who's coming from the outside to get you is low. Your friends who are there are going to have to rescue.
Correct.
Right, Dean?
It takes our group hours to respond, gear up, get to the scene, figure out where to go, and begin the search. Avalanche rescue has to be companion rescue mm-hmm. from the group that's already there. And it's best if every single member of that group is wearing an avalanche transceiver and it's on transmit. They've all been checked at the beginning of the day. At the end of the day, if everybody's fine, you just turn those off and go home. But if someone is missing under a snowslide, everyone else in the group can immediately turn their transceivers to the search function and pretty quickly get to the right area and begin probing. It takes practice, it takes training, but it's worth it to save the lives of one of your friends.
Yeah, and there's no skimping on that stuff, right, Steve? I mean, you have to have that. I mean, that's like, not negotiable.
Right. People go out and spend hundreds of dollars on a new smartphone, but they mm-hmm. won't spend the money for, an avalanche beacon or a PLB. Another thing is get some training. The Department of Public Safety, since 2011, has contracted with a private company to deliver free avalanche education for the public. Since our avalanche deaths have gone down here in Alaska, but our search and rescues have not gone down, we've changed that a little bit this year to be a backcountry safety awareness class. Our contractor this year is the North American Outdoor Institute out of Palmer. And they can look in their website. They can get a free class, costs nothing. They can tailor the class. If you've got a group of fairly experienced people that want a little bit more training, a little bit more in-depth stuff, we can get that going for you. Or if you've got just some basic stuff for, say, you and your teenagers before you go on a hike or you start your summer hiking season, they can tailor that to you. So mm-hmm. it's get some information.
And we'll have that link on our website so folks can find that training opportunity. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about mountain rescue, backcountry rescue, with a couple of the experts who mobilize and get out there and find people when they're lost. Lieutenant Steve Adams is a state coordinator for rescue with Alaska State Troopers, and Dean Knapp is one of the leaders of the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, a volunteer group here in Anchorage. I'd like to talk a little bit about who gets lost. In looking at the stats that you shared with me, Dean, which are on our website, looks like the biggest groups are hikers and snow machiners. And then skiers, I was surprised, was a much smaller number than folks who are on snowmobiles. Hikers, obviously, there's a zillion hikers out there in the summer. So a large number of people to get in trouble, and so in terms of what percentage of them do, I don't know. But just starting with that at the summer, and then we'll get into snow machine issue in a minute. There's a lot more mountain running taking place. Folks who are out going very, very light and high level of fitness, and maybe we'll go up a mountain and back down again in a couple hours that we would have thought of as a long day hike in the past. Are you seeing folks like that get in trouble? Are they, because they're not taking all this stuff with them, or is that not a big issue that you're running into? I'd like to hear from both of you on that. But super light travel, super fit folks, going out and not really bringing a lot of gear with them. I don't know the answer. So, Steve?
I really don't see much of an issue with it. Mm-hmm. Like you said, our biggest percentage of search and rescues is dedicated pretty much to snow machiners, except for this year. We really don't have any snow this year,
yeah,
so we really haven't had any snow machine search and rescues this year. and hikers. And then it also depends on the time of the year, too. September is our busiest month for search and rescues because of hunting season. Mm-hmm. And we have a situation where we've got a lot of people who haven't been in the woods since last hunting season that get out into the woods and, you know, they haven't prepared properly and they get themselves mm-hmm. into weather or, you know, swollen creeks and things. So it's a very busy time of the year for us.
So it sounds like a lot of your hiking rescues, Dean, are situations where people are just ill-prepared, especially since there so many of them are Flat Top and Crow Pass. Probably folks who maybe don't know what they're doing as much as maybe an experienced mountain runner would.
Well, I do remember one case for a mountain runner, but she was not very experienced. She mm-hmm. had won the Mayor's Midnight Marathon here in town and then moved to the mountains mm-hmm. and failed in navigation. Mm-hmm. Apparently she could really move, but she mistook a valley and didn't know a trail somewhere. She, mm-hmm. up in the Pinnacle Creek trailhead area. And she was out a night or two and just kept moving and moving and moving, which athletes will do. Same profile with a U.S. Marine who was lost once near Gold Mint Trailhead up in the Hatcher Pass area. He just kept going and going and going.
He's so fit that he figured, I'll just keep moving until I get out of here.
Yeah.
Just like the runner. Yeah.
And in Alaska.
Not the right strategy.
In Alaska, that can be a really bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of search and rescue in the States is in areas that are more settled. There are more roads and bridges. And 8-year-old kids have been told, if you get lost, find a stream and just go downstream, it will lead you to civilization.
Mm-hmm. I remember being told that, yeah.
That may be a really good idea in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
In Alaska, that could kill you.
Right, because it could be 50, 100 miles before you hit anything or much longer. Yeah.
That strategy will lead people into the Susitna River Canyon south of Denali Highway mm-hmm. and its massive wilderness up there.
Yeah, yeah. So why are snow machiners getting in trouble so much? Steve, do you have a sense for that? I mean, why is that? Is it just because they're can go fast and get out to extreme places, or do you?
I think that's right. They get further out much faster. We've got some folks that don't manage their fuel very well.
Mm-hmm.
Still the same, ill prepared. They don't carry the PLBs or some sort of communication device, and or they just plain get stuck. You know, so the years that we actually have snow,
that's easy to do. Yeah,
yeah. Sometimes they don't do well on the machine, or it's too late in the day and the temperature is too warm and the snow gets rotten. So,
yeah. Do you do many of those rescues, Dean, with your group?
Those tend to be small operations that usually the state trooper helicopter and one observer take care of.
You have the advantage that there's a track there that you can follow, so it would be much easier to find, I suppose.
Well, the problem is, at the trailhead, there are usually 800 tracks because
right.
a lot of people have been circling and loading and unloading snow machines, and you don't know which valley, which track is leading you to.
Mm-hmm.
They are at the end of one of those tracks.
Right.
But this was part of the advantage of our previous ability to fly at night with the night vision goggles. If the guys on the ground made any kind of light, it was probably the only light within 10, 12 miles, and the helicopter would go over and say, there they are, mm-hmm. bring them home.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot would write down the coordinates and say, your snow machines are here. Good luck.
Let's see. Yeah, yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We just have a few minutes left talking about backcountry rescue with Dean Knapp from Alaska Mountain Rescue Group and Lieutenant Steve Adams with Alaska State Troopers. Dean, how do you guys get your personnel? How do you get new members? And what kind of training do you do to make sure that everybody's safe? It seems like there's a lot of things that could go wrong with the kind of stuff you're doing.
Correct. We try to recruit people with backgrounds in outdoor adventure. A lot of climbers, some boaters, people who are pretty savvy out in the woods already. And then we take them through a basic training program where we introduce them to topics, we give them a quick introduction to everything we'll be doing in mountain rescue. And we get to see them in the field during a couple of these things. From the trainee's point of view, it's I'm being trained to be in the mountain rescue group. From the point of view of the instructor, we're saying, is this guy or woman safe to be on a search with us? And not going to get in trouble. So we look at their abilities and their gear and their cool-headedness, because the adrenaline can kill them. If, you know, somebody's screaming for help and you rush right into it blind, it's a bad situation for everybody.
Yeah, and I guess you're looking for people who want to avoid adventure to some extent, because this is a situation where an adventure is bad, right? Safety, calm, you know, everything going right.
It's yeah, you want your search and rescue missions to be kind of dull. You don't want great photos of people clinging to the skids of helicopters.
Yeah. Steve, from the perspective of the troopers, we're all very lucky that we have these volunteer groups. You know, you must feel that way all the time, because you couldn't do this job without them.
Absolutely. We are very, very fortunate in this state to have the search and rescue network that we have. In fact, I travel to conferences in Lower 48 and talk to other search and rescue coordinators, and the problems that they have, typically because they silo themselves in, because their search and rescue in Lower 48 is typically run by a sheriff. And so, you know, you always have the battle for resources. The fact that everything is coordinated through the state here, and all of the resources come together as one team, whether they're federal, state, or local partners, or the volunteer partners, we've got it really good here. And we're very, very fortunate to have, especially so many volunteers. We have, at any given time, up to 800 dedicated volunteers around the state.
That's amazing. Do you have to vet them at all? I mean, it seems like there'd be some risk that if you're sending people out who maybe are not at the level like Dean's talking about, well trained, you're going to have more people to rescue. Is that an issue that you have to deal with?
It is from time to time. We did lose one untrained volunteer that wasn't a part of a search and rescue group during a search and rescue. Coming up on 2 years now, in the Fairbanks area. We try to do what we can to provide for that training. We try to get the introduction to search and rescue classes out to them through the National Association for Search and Rescue. We then try to get them to go on to the fundamentals of search and rescue and advanced search and rescue. And then the last class is the managing the lost person incident. Or there are also other equivalents through other agencies as well. But we try to provide those in different regions of the state to get, basically make very dedicated, untrained volunteers into trained volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's amazing, and it's a great system, and I'm really glad it's there, because I hope I never have to call on it, but I feel confident that if I do, I'm going to get some help. I want to thank both my guests, Dean Knapp from Alaska Mountain Rescue, Lieutenant Steve Adams, you just heard from the Alaska State Troopers. Earlier, we heard from Aaron Kittredge about the Susitna 100. On next week's show, we're going to be talking about the Iron Dog, the longest, toughest snow machine race in the world, and really something that's amazing that I want to learn a lot more about. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Kristen Platt. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.